Senza, music by David Zahavi, performed by Carl Wacker. So good morning, everybody, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Matt Wise. My pronouns are he, him. I am married to Judy Wacker. She grew up here in Prairie, and we moved here together from California just about 2 years ago. And when our youngest hit 6 months, we've started coming, or at least I've been coming with our older daughter, Abby, as Naomi's asleep right now. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We strive to be welcoming to all, though we recognize that we all have biases that limit our understanding of how others may perceive us and how we may perceive others. We stumble in our efforts, but we commit to keep trying, to grow our ability to love people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender identity, family structure, age, or abilities. We have a few announcements. Prairie WOW will meet on Saturday, August 6th at 10 a.m. Prairie's women's group, Women of Wonder, meets the first Saturday of almost every month at 10 a.m. All women associated with Prairie are welcome to attend, especially newcomers. Our service on August 7th is Wilma's Fund, working to address homelessness and housing insecurity among LGBTQ+ people in Dane County, by A.J. Hardy. And please save the date for Saturday, September 25th, for our building dedication service, followed by a festive fall fair, welcoming Prairie folks and the community with open house tours, fun activities, food, and raffle. Our chalice lighting this morning is by Maureen Killeran and will be read by Rachel Long.
We are called today, from the midst of pain and challenge, we are called to praise the world. From a world that appears broken, we are called to praise life's moments of joy and grace. From time that seems to freeze in ongoing exchanges of platitudes and blame, we are called to reach out to those around us, to connect with those we care about, and to try to make amends with those from whom we are estranged. The world is too fragile. There is too much pain. Let us bring our hearts together on this day. Let us praise the mutilated world in all its blessing and its pain.
Thank you, Rachel. Our opening music is number 1021, Lean on Me, in the teal hymnal, under the seat in front of you. Please stand if you can.
not strong, and I'll be your friend, and I'll help you carry on, for it won't be long till I'm gonna need somebody to lean on. Please swallow your pride if I have things you need to buy. When you're not strong, and I'll be your friend, I'll help you carry on, for it won't be long till I'm gonna need somebody to lean on. If there is a load you have to that you can't carry, I'm right up the road, I'll share your load. If you just call me, lean on me, when you're not strong, and I'll be your friend, I'll help you carry on. Somebody to lean on. Just call on me, brother, when you need a hand. We all need somebody to lean on. I just might have a problem that you understand. We all need somebody to lean on.
It's time for our story for all ages. I'm making a change to the order, so this will be a surprise if you are looking forward to the one in the order of service. The book is called The Hating Game by Charlotte Zolotow. We welcome adults as well as kids to come forward and get a good view of the pictures while we listen to our story. After the story, we'll sing them out.
All right, so the book is called The Hating Book. Okay. I hated my friend. When I moved over in the school bus and she sat somewhere else, when her point broke in arithmetic and I passed her my pencil, she took Peter's instead. Ask her, my mother said, ask your friend why. But I wouldn't, I couldn't, I'd rather die. What if she would say, oh please, just go away. You're ugly and dumb. Being with you was never fun. Oh, I hated my friend. When it was her turn to wash the board, she didn't ask me to help. When it was time to choose teams, she didn't choose me. And when I made a basket and everyone else yelled, yay, she turned away. Oh, I hated my friend. When I went to walk home with her, she had already gone. When she took her dog out and I whistled to him, she put him on a leash and led him away. Oh, I hated my friend. Ask her, my mother said. Ask her why. I couldn't. I'd rather die. No, if that's the way she was going to be, it's quite okay with me. Ask her, my mother said. Ask and see. I wouldn't, I couldn't, but maybe. You've been so rotten, I said. Why? She looked as though she'd cry. It's you, she said. Last week when I wore my new dress, Sue said, Jane said, you said, I looked like a freak. I did not. I said you looked neat. She looked straight at me for a while, and then we both began to smile. My friend said, hey, maybe tomorrow we can play. Oh, yes, I said. Okay. I didn't hate her anyway. I wish it were tomorrow. The end.
As you go along your way, may you be filled with gladness. Go in joy, go in joy. May fortune bless your day with peace and loving kindness. Go in love, go in love.
Thank you, Alice. We will now have a moment of silent meditation. So I'm going to be presenting a talk that I've titled The Dangers to Society of Social Media. This presentation relates to a couple of our UU principles. The fourth, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. I don't have the listing in front of me. But respect for the democratic process. As well as goals of community, worldwide community. So I'm going to start a little bit with some of my story and how I got into this topic as something that's interesting to me. For a long time, I've been a non-user of social media. That's kind of where I came from. I remember when Facebook was brand new, and I just didn't get it. Why are people so excited about posting pictures of their breakfast? And I subsequently got more into the topics of privacy and the ideas that this is just a massive data collection effort and how it's used for targeted advertising and how there are limited checks on the distribution of this private information. It's being used for dragnet surveillance without warrants. And all of that didn't sit well with me. I felt like there was this growing culture of people having private conversations by shouting them out to the world. And that didn't make sense to me. So I've been a non-user of Facebook, of Twitter, of Instagram for a very long time, for over a decade. And then my daughter was born, my first daughter, Abigail. And she's been here for the last several months, so some of you may have gotten a chance to meet her. And I suddenly felt a desire to be able to post pictures of her because I had lots of friends, I had lots of family who said, oh, we want to see pictures. And it seemed obvious that, well, if I could put it in one place where everybody could see it, that'd be great. But I still had all these concerns about privacy and I didn't trust these centralized platforms. So I did what, you know, any decent person with an engineering background does. I built my own. I tried really hard not to build my own. I'd heard that, you know, WordPress is the right system for this type of thing, and it's infinitely configurable, and I tried doing that. And it is infinitely configurable, and it's easy to get wrong. And even when I thought I had everything locked down so that I had to create accounts for people to be able to access, I still, every week, had to go through and clean out all the spam signup requests that I don't even know how they were getting to it. And so I, you know, started building my own system up from scratch, which, you know, now I call Haven. And I decided, you know, this is something that was interesting and valuable to me, and I wanted other people to be able to do it. So I, you know, made the software open source, and I tried to make it as easy to use as possible. But something else happened, which was I started paying much closer attention to what was going on in the world, in this space, in the social media world, the writings and publications, people who are talking about it, and the bigger issues beyond just privacy that were really wrong with this paradigm that has kind of taken over our world. There's an individual, his name is Jonathan Haidt. He is a social psychologist and professor of ethical leadership at the New York University Stern School of Business. He published a piece in July of this year in April this year, titled Why the Past 10 Years of American Life Have Been Uniquely Stupid. And it's a great read. I encourage you to take a look at it. He draws lots of parallels between the way that people interact online on social media and the Tower of Babel, you know, our just inability to communicate and interact. It's a long-form piece in The Atlantic. I'm not going to go through all of it. He's also published work about how social media is damaging to the mental health, particularly of teenage women. And he testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Teen mental health is plummeting, and social media is a major contributing cause. His original piece by The Atlantic, Facebook published a rebuttal. He's got a recent reaffirmation out. They basically said, no, it's not our fault. And he said, yeah, it is. that piece is called Yes, Social Media Really Is Undermining Democracy. And I've got a couple quotes from there. Coming across contrary viewpoints on social media, says sociologist Zeynep Tufekci in a 2018 essay, is, quote, not like reading them in a newspaper while sitting alone. Rather, she said, quote, it's like hearing them from the opposing team while sitting with our fellow fans in a football stadium. We bond with our team by yelling at the fans of the other one. More exposure to different sources of news doesn't automatically break open echo chambers. In fact, it can reinforce them. And this is a lot of what interaction online ends up being. You see somebody who's wrong. There's somebody wrong on the internet. Oh my gosh. And people feel compelled to correct them. But that means the only interaction, the only thing that this person knows about you is you're somebody who they don't know who's telling you they're wrong. Like, how dare you? What are you doing in my feed? And so it's really heightened this sense of division. And the way that we interact just at its core becomes one that's not about unity and understanding, but more about taking sides. And it's become so strong that targets of people doing things wrong are not even so much the other side, but members of our own tribe who are not following the party line. This is another quote from Jonathan Haidt's most recent article. This fear of getting shamed, reported, doxxed, fired, or physically attacked is responsible for the self-censorship and silencing of dissent. When dissent within any group or institution is stifled, the group will become less perceptive, less nimble, and less effective over time. So there's another author and speaker who's decided that this is a really important topic. That's Barack Obama. In April of this year, he gave a keynote speech at Stanford titled Challenges to Democracy in the Digital Information Realm. If Barack Obama thinks this is important enough that when invited to speak at Stanford, this is the topic that he chooses to focus on, that's a pretty big signal that something clearly is going wrong that deserves our attention. I've talked so far about, you know, Jonathan Haidt and Barack Obama. There's another piece from 2021 in the New York Times. I didn't catch the author's name, but it was titled Buying Influence: How China Manipulates Facebook and Twitter. And so from these kind of resources that I started coming across, and there's lots more out there, Barack Obama has a Medium account, a blog, where he's actually posted a suggested reading list ahead of the speech that he gave. And there are a lot of really good resources there for building some context and understanding, trying to understand what's going on. But there are some themes that I started to notice. One of these is, you know, privacy. This is what got me started on this. I've talked some about targeted advertising and dragnet surveillance. Terrifying is a better word, anecdote about an individual, I think around the Milwaukee area, who was detained by police. He had no idea why. And it turned out that there was a murder in a neighborhood. Then the police asked Google for the location information of anybody who had been within a 1 mile radius of that location. And that happened to be on his bike route. So they said, this person seems to has repeatedly shown up in this area. Let's go detain him and figure out what's going on. No warrants, no probable cause, just dragnet surveillance. And there's lots of discussion about what should be the role of police, but at the very minimum, they should need to demonstrate a warrant or a reason to gather private information, and that's not what's happening. When all of this information exists in the hands of private companies, the police can just ask, and they often get way more than they ought to. There's a quote, give me 6 lines written by any individual, and in them I will find in them a reason to hang him. And I did a little bit of digging to figure out the origin of this quote. It was a French cardinal, Cardinal Richelieu, and the quote actually came from a memorialist who was describing this individual many years later, so the veracity is potentially questionable. But a translation of the quote from his memorial was, Cardinal Richelieu was in the habit of saying that with 2 lines of a man's handwriting, an accusation could be made against the most innocent, because the business can be interpreted in such a way that one can easily find what one wishes. And just that idea that with so much out there, anybody can be found guilty of something. And so if you're looking to attack somebody, there's plenty out there to frame something however you want. And so privacy is important. Privacy is important. But that's only the first of these themes that I noticed. The second, as I've described a lot, is the way that social media platforms are inherently divisive. They strip away the human contact and leave behind nothing but the discord or the discourse, however you want to frame it. You aren't talking with people, you're talking with somebody whose words are clearly wrong, and the most important thing in the moment is to point out that they're right. But this isn't even the only game that's happening. You've got, at least in the US, we've got left and a right, but we've also got a huge community of trolls, of people who think it's fun to antagonize online. And so not even anybody who you're engaging with is coming at it with an intent of even the possibility of trying to learn. They're just trying to get your goat. And when you get this type of culture clash, it just explodes and degenerates. And a contributing factor in the platforms that exist today is the way that they are optimized. They're free because they show ads, and they show more ads if you spend more time there. And so they're optimized for engagement. Engagement is the magic word in Silicon Valley. Engagement means doing whatever it takes to get you to stay there longer. Engagement means showing you whatever you're going to interact with, whatever they think you're going to interact with. And this means these platforms are primed to take controversial topics and make them go viral, to spread their awareness. There's a story I learned about from Barack Obama's reading list. Somebody parallel parked his car in a really tight spot, and he was really proud of it. And so he took a picture of his car in this really tight spot, posted it to his Twitter, and said, "I'm really good at parallel parking." The internet was furious. Somehow this got the attention of lots of people. One person posted, "You're an objectively bad human being for taking that spot, for trapping these other cars." He thought this was kind of funny, and he took a screenshot of that tweet and reposted it and said, "I'm being canceled on the internet for being good at parallel parking." And that got even more attention. You know, people were yelling at him for not respecting differently abled people. This exploded. Why should this be the thing that explodes in popularity? Why should this be the thing that gets shoved in everybody's feeds and everybody's faces? And one of the reporters who dug into this story, you know, found that individual who said, "Hey, you're an objectively bad person." And they said, "Oh yeah, I was just making a joke, trying to entertain my followers." You know, weren't you doing the same thing when you said that you reposted it to your much larger follower base? And it's like, well, yeah. And so how much of this discourse is about trying to communicate, trying to interact, versus trying to entertain, we ourselves have become conditioned to try and post things that people will engage in because we get all of those social rewards. And this leads to the next theme, which in my mind is even scarier, which is that social media platforms can be manipulated. And all of these systems are trying to design themselves around treating an account as a person, and if lots of accounts are engaging with something, then that must mean it's popular and we should show it to more people, hence the viral loop. But an account isn't necessarily a person. And even if it is, it may not be an individual operating on their own. State-level actors have enormous resources to direct the flow of conversations, to affect what shows up in your Facebook or Twitter feeds or Instagram or TikTok. They have enormous resources to sway the public opinion in other countries, and that's terrifying. That's terrifying. As a society, you know, we haven't had a chance to, after the 2016 elections, there was lots of discussion, Russian interference with elections, but our president at the time was trying to quell lots of the investigation, and you know, clearly something was going on, and we may never actually know the full scope of it. But just knowing how feasible it is to do that type of thing as a citizen is terrifying to me. The current newest crop of social media, the newest social media platform called TikTok, is in fact owned by China. And in June, Brendan Carr, commissioner with the FCC, said, "At its core, TikTok functions as a sophisticated surveillance tool that harvests extensive amounts of personal and sensitive data." He was arguing to Google and Apple that TikTok should be removed from their app stores, at least in the US, because he sees it as a national security concern. And he was just speaking to the data collection side, to China knowing probably more about the rapid change in culture that exists and what's currently popular than our own government does. It's terrifying. So where is it going? A lot of what we're seeing, this challenge of engagement-optimized platforms pushing content at you, this is a space called content discovery. Because if Facebook did what they said they're supposed to do, which was help you keep up with your friends, see what they're up to, and let them see what you're up to, you wouldn't spend enough time on the platform for them to make, I think in the last quarter of 2021, they made over $60 per American and Canadian user of Facebook, just showing them ads. That's because they're able to keep you on the platform, because they keep pushing stuff on into your feed, because they're playing this role of content discovery. And this is the future of these platforms. TikTok came along and said, I'm not even going to bother pretending that it's about who you're connected to or what they're doing. We're just going to show you stuff. And it's like, I've heard people describing it as, injecting heroin directly into your brain, right? It's that effective, because it just shows you things, and the algorithm is really good at what it does. And all it does is take information based on what you're looking at, what you say you're interested in. I think last week, Facebook rolled out a redesign that made it very TikTok-like, very much focusing on their discovery engine, and not on the feed, which then became the news feed, which is now what it is. So this whole premise of connecting people, connecting you to your own social network, which is a personal thing, it's not a technical thing, it's a personal thing, has totally been destroyed in favor of content discovery, keeping you on the platform, selling you ads. But all of the vices, all of the risks, all of the dangers are still there. So I want to bring this back to this thing that I decided to start building. Me and Abigail started coming a couple months ago, and I think the first service we came to, I overheard Rachel Long make some comment about be careful what you're doing on social media. And so I caught up with her at the prayer retreat, and I said, hey, we should talk. I'm building this thing. I'd love to hear more of your thoughts. And she said, you should give a talk. So I'm here. It's her fault. She also pointed me at a podcast that was on WNYC called Ghost in the Machine. And specifically, there's an individual named Eli Pariser. And he is working towards defining hope. What do our digital platforms need in order for us to have a more coherent society? He's got a piece from 2020 in Wired titled, To Mend a Broken Internet, Create Online Parks. And I don't know what an online park looks like. And I'm not sure if he does either, but it's an idea. It's hope. It's a way that we can start thinking about a better way to move forward. You know, maybe online parks are Minecraft, where you've got a chance to get together and maybe you're connecting with random people, but it's about a thing that you both care about. And that's much more the way that we interact as human beings in the world. You know, if you meet someone at a park, you talk about the grass and the beautiful weather and the dogs that are pooping on the grass and the cute kids that are running around, the way the leaves change color in the autumn, right? You don't start spewing political views back and forth. But on the internet, all interactions get stripped down to just that. So Haven, what is Haven? It's free software, it's open source software, it's designed for everybody to be able to run themselves. I look at the incentives that exist, not just from Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, but from any potentially new social network. And that is, if somebody's running it, if they're spending money to run it, then they're going to be incentivized to try and make more money off of it. And those are the core incentives that mess up our existing systems. But if we have something that's distributed, that's federated, email is a really great technical example of this, a thing that's distributed and federated. No one person owns email. As much as Google and Microsoft may be heading in that direction, that's a totally different topic. But anybody can run an email server, and they can talk to anybody else who's running an email server. And so email has remained this incredibly valuable, useful tool for interaction since it came about. And not much has changed about it as a technology, as a protocol, but it remains incredibly valuable and incredibly useful and really relatively low on the drama scale. So I wanted to take that core model, that distributed model, and say with Haven, if anybody can run their own, And when I say run their own, this is your own private website where you get to choose who sees it. You have to send an invitation to anybody who gets to see the things that you post. But then the platforms, once you've got access to somebody else's, they can pull information from each other using the same technology that lots of websites today are already broadcasting with, this technology called the RSS feed, which is a technology that's almost as old as email. It used to be built right into web browsers. The idea was you didn't want to have to be able to visit all of these different websites, and so you could subscribe to them. You could subscribe to a website, and the website could publish updates, and your web browser could let you know when there are updates from different sites and even collect all that information in a feed. So this is what Haven is. Haven lets you create your own series of posts in a space that you control with access that you hand out, and also aggregate updates, both from private updates of people who you care about, as well as public updates from public websites. And there are lots of them. Probably 3/4 of the websites that I visit publish RSS feeds. It's not a very discussed technology anymore. Not that many people use it. And there's additional backstory there that I am going to avoid getting into. But together, this gives you a very social media type experience with full control. There's no longer any engagement optimized system. There's no longer any central entity that knows what everybody's looking at. It's your own system. It's your own server. And so you're in full control of what you see. You say, I want to listen to this website, and these three people, and that's the content you're going to see. And when it runs out, now you have read everything and you're up to date. You can move on with your life, just like with your email. So that's Haven. That's my project. I've been running one with pictures of Abby and now Naomi for 3+ years, and I love it, even though nobody else I know is using one. I still use it to fetch all of the stuff that I generally want to keep up with on the internet. I do indoor bicycling on this platform called Zwift, and there's a Zwift community website that publishes an RSS feed, maybe a little bit more frequently than I'd like, but I get all of my updates right there inside of my Haven, and it's great. So what should all of you do? Of all the people who I've quoted who have talked about the dangers and the challenges with social media, almost nobody provides concrete steps or advice on what the alternative or what we can do instead. And I know it's not feasible to say everybody should delete their Facebook and Twitter and never go on there. That's not going to happen. But you can pay attention to what you're engaging with. There's a common business expression, no press is bad press, right? And the same is true for content online. If somebody's wrong on the internet and you take your time writing a detailed, well-cited article about why they're wrong, the platforms are going to say, oh, this is engaging content, let's show it to more people. So through the act of disagreeing with something, you're amplifying it. And it's important to be aware of that so that you are making fully informed decisions about how you interact online. And remember that it's still people. It's still people on the other side. And they may be preaching a view that you don't agree with, but they're still people. And I bet that if you were to compare all of your values, there'd be a lot more in common than you have to disagree on. And the things that we disagree with are the items that we feel we need to pour a lot of energy into, but they're still people. As Bill and Ted said, be excellent to each other. The other thing I would encourage all of you to do is try using an RSS reader to follow the websites and curate your own source of information. There are lots of them out there. If you search RSS reader, you'll find lots of recommendations. I'll list out a couple. Feedly is one, iKnowReader, NewsBlur, The Old Reader, and Haven. And once you get a chance to have this taste of only reading your own curated content, your own curated source of information, you may get a different feel for what the internet can provide and what it can be. I want to close this with two quotes. One is from Jonathan Haidt, and he says, "The post-Babel world will not be rebuilt by today's technology companies. That work will be left to citizens who understand the forces that brought us to the verge of self-destruction and to develop the new habits, the new virtues, new technologies, and shared narratives that will allow us to reap the benefits of living and working together in peace." And in Barack Obama's keynote at Stanford, he ended with a very similar sentiment. The internet is a tool. Social media is a tool. And at the end of the day, tools don't control us. We control them. We can remake them. It's up to each of us to decide what we value and then use the tools we've been given to advance those values. Thank you. And with that, I will open it up to questions. I've got a spiel to read about questions. Now is the time that our community dedicates for discussion around the focus of today's service, relying upon our covenant of good relations as a guide to ensure all voices are welcomed and relationships are valued. If you're in the room, please come up to the mic so people on Zoom can see you. Please introduce yourself, otherwise raise your hand and somebody will bring a microphone to you.
Hi, my name is John Wunderlin and I'm a social media addict. I'm mostly kidding, but I am a consumer of social media, and I totally got into the political battles and lost some friends, some real life friends that I didn't even realize were conservatives, and the division that we ran into during the election was really breathtaking. But I feel like I've learned to really back away from politics on social media. The one thing I wanted to mention is a Netflix movie called The Social Dilemma. I think I've mentioned this before. If you haven't seen this, I think it's really worth watching. And it's, to me, all the social media platforms, I think 99% of the people who develop them probably had the best of intentions, and The Social Dilemma reinforces this. But they basically opened Pandora's box to the worst of human nature and have tied into, in some ways, without even realizing it, tied into some of our worst tribal instincts and have really caused this division. So Social Dilemma, if you haven't seen it, I really recommend it.
Thanks, John. I confess, I actually haven't seen it yet. But it's on my list. It's been on my list for a while. As you can imagine, between full-time job and young kids, there isn't a lot of time for media.
I'm Mary Franz, and I barely know what social media are. I use my computer for the things I want to use it for. But you have said how to protect yourself, but my concern is how do we protect vulnerable people who don't try to protect themselves? And is there any role, I hate to say this, for attempts to control social media, and whether it be governmental? I have no idea.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm afraid I don't have a good answer to it. I think there are lots of examples of places where government regulation just cannot keep up with the rate at which technology is advancing. And while I'm a big advocate of privacy, I'm also a big advocate of freedom, of letting people do what they want to do. And, you know, part of privacy and protecting vulnerable people are things like I don't post pictures of my kids online because I want them to be able to choose what their digital identity is constructed as. And they're not ready to make that decision yet. But I have a hard time imagining what effective government regulation could look like. I don't have the most confidence in our legislators in being able to be aware of what's going on to make informed decisions, unfortunately. That is their job, but unfortunately, that's the truth of it. So it's a great question, and I'm afraid I don't have a great answer for it.
I'm Gary Gates, and I was president of Prairie. Before I became president of Prairie, I never had a computer. My work career was involved in computerizing things, but I hated it. And so I got a computer because everybody communicated by email. And that's the only thing I use it for, other than look up the weather. But the thing that always struck me about it, and you haven't mentioned it, is I think the biggest flaw I see is anonymity. You can say anything you want and nobody knows who you are. And that, I think, really need to have some way of saying you're out there. If you say something, you can take responsibility for what you say. And the internet as it's now situated, as I understand it, you don't have to take responsibility for what you say. You say anything you want. And I think that's one of the big flaws in it.
Yeah, thanks for those thoughts. Anonymity is a double-edged sword. Because you're right, there are lots of people who use it as something to hide behind in order to say inflammatory things and hurtful things, cause damage, and then disappear. But it's also a really valuable shield for some of our more vulnerable populations. If you are in a line of work that may not be fully legal, you know, something like sex work, and that anonymity is the only way that you have of getting help. If you are a abuse victim, and that is the only safe way you have of reaching out and getting help, that's also really important. So I definitely have mixed feelings about this. And much like my previous comment, I don't have a good answer to it. It's a hard problem. The way that we interact as people is a hard problem.
I'm Chris Porter. My pronouns are she, her. Just yesterday, I saw that there was a settlement with Google in Illinois for very, very large millions of dollars, and people who in Illinois who used Google basically are going to get like a payout. And I do think like laws and things like that are kind of behind the curve, but maybe at some point that there will be a little bit more caution with some of these things that are getting brought to court.
Yeah, definitely. And we do see examples of regulation that's hopefully having some positive effects. The California Consumer Protection Act, the EU's GDPR, have had their positives and negatives. Now people can download all of the information that a company has about you and that they've inferred about you. I may have never told Google that I'm male, but if they've inferred that from me, that's something that they can tell me. But that's also created things like the cookie pop-up banners that has made the internet kind of a much more hostile place for people to interact. So positives and negatives. There's also pending legislation in the UK, which now being outside of the EU, is mandating that all websites do much more enhanced tracking and identify the ages of every visitor. And it's proposed, it hasn't gone through, but it could be a huge step backwards. So.
I'm Renee, she, her. Something I have to think about is, and you have to think about too, is when you have kids and they get older and they want to be on social media like probably a lot of their friends are, how I'm going to manage that, because I didn't grow up with social media. I grew up with technology. I'm like, you and I are probably, we're on the border of both. So I feel like I'm fairly savvy, but I'm also cautious. Like I'm in this kind of middle thing. And I haven't really figured out yet how we're going to handle our kids wanting social media accounts. One thing I do want to talk to them about, though, is being really careful with accounts that have your name, even just your first name, because people can, it's called doxing, but they can like post your address. It's really easy if you know someone's first and last name to figure out where they live. So something I want to convey to them is to be really careful about accounts that they use their first and last name with and what they're posting under it. An example of this would be that I knew I shouldn't have done it, but I got into it on a YouTube video about abortion. And you can imagine some of the comments. And I got into one of the comments and I kept mine, like I did not do personal attacks and I was like doing logical arguments for pro-choice. And this person basically did a death threat against me in a YouTube comment. And I was using an account that was not my legal first, like my username was not my first and last name. And I'm happy I did. But I mean, that really freaked me out to get a death threat. And something that people I don't think realize as much is the activist, the 19-year-old activist who got into it with Matt Gaetz and raised like $1.4 million for pro-choice, which is, on one hand, awesome. She raised $1.4 million. On the other hand, I bet you she has gotten so many death threats that we wouldn't even believe the things that she has gotten in her direct messages. And she hasn't shared that. I don't think she shared that with people, but I kind of wish people would share that more because I think women and people of color especially get a lot of harassment online. And like I said, I got a death threat on a YouTube comment and it freaked me out. And again, I was with a different account, but it really freaked me out. And that's why I really have to think about with my kids is on one hand, like you were saying, I think anonymity can be bad, but it also can be almost like needed to protect your safety. So I have to really think about when we're talking with our kids and what they're using their legal names for and all that jazz. And I mean, I have like 15 different email accounts and I purposely have an email account that does not have my first or last name. And I always encourage this to students was to have an email account that doesn't have your first and last name and give that to like, I don't know, like the prize drawing, just anything that you think that is not super really important or you're not really sure where this information is going because you don't know where it's all going. And you don't want to be handing out your private information to who knows who. But if you use the internet, it's going somewhere. So I don't know. That was a long ramble. But I don't know what to do with my kids. And I want to share that random thing on my YouTube comment. And no, I have not gotten into it on YouTube again after that.
Yeah, the internet is it's a scary place. And there's another, you know, doxing is publishing personal information. You may not have heard of swatting, where you call in, hey, I heard that there was a bomb at this building, send the SWAT team, and they send the SWAT team to somebody's house. And there are stories that pop up on the news once in a while of, you know, somebody got swatted and they had a heart attack when the SWAT team came to their door and they passed away. And this was, you know, intended as a joke by some 14-year-old kid who heard on the forums that this is a funny thing to do and tried it out, but now someone's dead. I think if there's anybody else, we've got time for maybe one more question. Otherwise, we can move on. We are sharing our offering this quarter with Wilma's Fund, which provides assessments and assistance to LGBTQ plus people who are experiencing homelessness, as well as support to prevent homelessness in this population. The offertory is Shova Yonim, an Israeli folk song performed by Carl Wacker. Thank you. Closing Words by Stephen J. Crump will be read by Renee Deschard.
That which is worthy of doing, create with your hands. That which is worthy of repeating, speak with a clear voice. That which is worthy of remembering, hold in your hearts. And that which is worthy of living, go and live it now.
Our closing music is Blue Boat Home in your teal hymnal number 1064. At this time, we are stopping the recording.